Blog Talk Radio.
General Quarters, Security Condition 3.
GQ, Security 3, sir. General Quarters 3, intruder alert. GQ 3, intruder alert.
All right, welcome once again to Madame Perry Salon. I'm delighted to have you here in the Genie Bottle. I am your host and cruise director, Madame Perry, or Jennifer Perry, call me. And just want to say, first of all, thank you once again. You know, I find myself so grateful and thanking you every week, every night, every show, because this show has been growing right now, this year, more than even I expected it to, and I'm grateful to you for making that happen. If you haven't subscribed yet, you can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Blueberry, if you subscribe also on Blog Talk Radio. And if you're listening live right now on Blog Talk Radio, you can also click the pink rectangle that says in white letters, follow. And that way you'll always know who's coming next so you won't miss anybody fun. Although, with the podcast, the cool thing is that you listen live and you can call in live, but you can also listen to it later. Some people, I get a lot of downloads on the weekend when I don't broadcast because people sometimes like to listen at a leisurely pace on their weekends, like I do too with podcasts. But also because of you subscribing and listening and sharing this with your friends and sharing all the links on your own social media, that enables me to get good sponsors, and it also helps me to get great guests like I've been having, like I've got coming up, and like I have tonight. Just to go over a couple of things so recently, first of all, let me say the winner of Lita Ford's book, and of course the winner was drawn, I don't do it myself, I like to keep it straight on the up and up, the winner was drawn by Titch McLean, who's a Scottish actor, lives in Glasgow. He drew the winner of Lita Ford's book, Living Like a Runaway, and the winner was Larry Boomer Brumley, who's been a listener and a sponsor of this show for a long time, about 2 years, I think. So congratulations, Larry. You should have it in the mail by now. Also, if you remember, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, David Fishoff was my guest, and David Fishoff is for years, he's been an agent, producer, mostly a television producer, but also an agent for people with in sports and entertainment. He created the Ringo Starr All-Star Band. That was his idea. And he also created Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. And the new one starts next week. You can still register. It's the Judas Priest edition, so it'll be the members of Judas Priest, as well as some coaches like Rudy Sarzo, bassist for Quiet Riot, Ozzy, I guess who's been on here before, his brother Robert Sarzo, and a few other people that you know well will be your coaches and counselors. If you register for Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp for the one that starts, I think it's next week, the Judas Priest edition, and when you register, if you mention that you heard about it from Madame Perry, if you heard about it on Madame Perry Salon, when you register, then when you get there to Hollywood, the owner, David Fishoff, will give you a guitar valued at $700. It doesn't matter how many of you do it. Anyone who mentions Madame Perry Salon will get a guitar valued at $700 from David Fishoff himself, and that's a pretty cool thing, I think. Also, see, who else have we had lately? Oh, last night, Robert Leland Taylor with his new book, Through the Ant Farm. We had Michael Fleeman 2 weeks ago. This is the second time this year because he has two books out this year. This one was called, The Black Widower. The Black Widower is his newest. And, of course, Michael Fleeman, you've probably seen him on a lot of television shows about true crime. But he's also going to be a featured host on a new show on the Escape Channel. It's called Deep Undercover. But his two books this year were Crazy for You, which was about the Rusty Snyderman murder that happened in Atlanta, Georgia, and a few years back. And then the newest one, Black Widow, about a man who had two wives that died in very bizarre circumstances, you know, kind of out of the way, no witnesses, kind of a freak accident. And but he was caught and he is in prison. And so it's always fun to have Michael Fleeman here. He's a great writer and a great guest. And coming soon, I think we're going to have Ray D'Africo from The Night Porter's back, Cheetah Chrome from Dead Boys, Batusis, and Rocket from the Tombs. He's on. Cheetah Chrome will be back. Kate Canavas, who was on here before with her book about surviving cancer land. She has a new book about dream interpretations, and she will be interpreting your dreams here. And you might have seen her recently. She was a featured guest on the Dr. Oz show. And Kat will be back on here in October. So I'm excited about that. It's a nice guest I'm very excited about, too. I've known of her and know of her. We have a lot of mutual friends for several years. Quite an impressive lady, and I'm thrilled to have her here. Most people know her as a poet, as an author. She's an associate professor and incoming associate chair at Georgia Tech School of Literature, Media, Communication, and the executive director of the Communication Center. She's also the editor of the Southern Discourse in the Center, a journal of multiliteracy and innovation, and the editor of the Atlanta Review. She has published 4 books of poetry and has exhibited acclaimed digital poetry projects, has one that's coming in forth in spring 2017. Most of her research is focused on communication theory, pedagogical practice, specifically regarding the implementation and development of writing centers, writing program administration, and multidisciplinary communication. And I have to say, and this is a very bold move, something about her I just recently learned, and I admire her guts and boldness doing this, her bravery, but she confessed, and for someone who holds a PhD in English with a focus on American writers, this may seem like complete and utter sacrilege. And yet she revealed that she confessed, actually, that she really hates Moby Dick. So please welcome my guest tonight at Madame Perry Salon, Karen Head, PhD. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you? I feel heard always about the genie bottle, and you know, we're just coming off of Dragon Con here in Atlanta, and you know, I sort of felt like I needed to go out and get my genie costume and turn into pink smoke and come down into the interview tonight.
Carrie, you wear it well. You really do. You're a woman of a lot of surprises, you know, so well done. I'm wondering who helped you choose this. Was it your husband, Colin, or was it our mutual friend, Colin Kelly?
I think either of them could be guilty of this. So we'll leave the mystery out there. As if having, two Collins in my life is not confusing enough for some people sometimes.
Yeah, it seems like I get the feeling sometimes, especially from photos on social media or things that I see, that they share you. So, hey, more power to you, sister. So tonight, right, though, we want to talk about, and I've been telling people that we're going to talk about this brand new book of yours that's still a very hot topic, is Disrupt This: MOOCs and the Promises of Technology. And a lot of people, I guess, in education, academia, understand MOOCs. But MOOCs, I understand, stands for Massive Open Online Courses. And so for those where this is new, and I've been learning from interviews I've seen on BBC and TEDx talks and reading things that you've written, but just as an introduction, could you define MOOCs for the layperson?
Sure. So as Silicon Valley is sort of famous for doing, they always want to look at any industry and see if there isn't a way that that they can digitize that industry or streamline that using technology online. And so, you know, most of us are fairly aware of some of those things, like, you know, as media has gone online and your show is available online, where, you know, at one point that would not have been the case. We would have needed a radio, and we would both be having to sit in the studio. So a group of professors at a couple of universities, mostly at Stanford, decided that they wanted to see what it would be like to offer courses and to offer them to as many people as could sign up for a particular course online. And the idea originally was to bring the sort of best and brightest lecturers at these top elite schools to the masses. So the very first MOOCs came out of Stanford. They came out of Harvard. Harvard, another place that had that built one of the platforms that these MOOCs ran on. And it was kind of a teach the world mentality. The idea that was that they were open, which meant they were free. You know, giving people access to information. And the first courses were for the most part in areas like computer science, where there was kind of a natural, tie-in to it being online. And as it grew over time and these platforms evolved, and so there were kind of three big players. Udacity and Coursera were the platforms that came from Stanford, and then edX came from Harvard and MIT. They started to sort of expand, and so what kinds of courses could we teach, and they were really very hot for a while. And then the question became, well, you know, if it's sort of everyday learning or continuing learning or learning for people who don't have access to universities, you know, could we actually run university classes? Could MOOCs become sort of a substitute? And so a lot of talk about disruption and disruption theory. So, do we really need universities if we can just take the best and brightest people at places like Harvard and Stanford and you know, eventually other universities became sort of part of that. Could we essentially just teach tens of thousands of people at a time or hundreds of thousands of people at a time? It was an intriguing idea. And a lot of people became interested in it. It got a lot of press. Tom Friedman, at the New York Times, famously, wrote about this, the year of the MOOCs, he called it. And a lot of people were sort of like, oh, okay, well, you know, maybe this is really going to be a thing. And it's not that distance ed or online education wasn't already sort of a thing, but it was more like traditional classrooms, but online. And MOOCs broke out of that. You know, they broke out of institutional homes. Anybody from anywhere could sort of take them. And again, they were free. But then there were a lot of questions about, how do people get credit for these things? And so there were lots of questions as and they grew really fast. So a lot of people were sort of, were jumping on the train. There's a lot of train metaphors that get used talking about MOOCs. The train's left the station. We need to be on the train. And I say in the book, there were moments when, honestly, I felt like we were not building the track fast enough, in front of us, and we had no idea where we were ultimately going to end up. But, it got a lot of press. A lot of people were paying attention. And then people like the Gates Foundation decided that, they wanted to fund some experiments, some classes. And that's where I got pulled into to the game. We were already experimenting with MOOCs at Georgia Tech. The Gates call for proposals came out, but they didn't want the traditional areas that had been represented. So they didn't want computer science. They wanted something different. And so first-year writing, which is pretty much, I think, one of the most ubiquitous college courses anywhere, You know, they wanted to know, could you teach those kinds of things? So I got sort of pulled into my, I famously laugh and say I was voluntold that I needed to do this. And I did, and I really didn't want to. It seemed like a really risky thing to do. I was not yet tenured, which, you know, is a thing that university professors have, you know, about 6 years to do the kind of research and get things published so that they can secure their job going forward. And I just really thought that this was going to be, you know, a terrible distraction, and I wasn't sure how my colleagues were going to think about me doing it. But at the end of the day, it was actually my husband who convinced me. He said, you know, I know that your inclination is to say no, but, you know, you are somebody who is not afraid of technology. Do you want to trust someone else to tell you whether or not this is a good thing, or do you want to find that out for yourself?
I like the way he thinks. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, and he knows me well enough to know that, you know, I'm a boots on the ground kind of person. You know, I think if you're not willing to get your hands dirty, then, you know, you don't get to be the same kind of sort of participant in the conversation, because people who are actually getting their hands dirty have, you know, I mean, they have street cred, right? I mean, they're willing to get in there and you know, oftentimes fail at something. So I agreed to teach one of these courses in first year writing, and I had about 22,000 students in my class.
Whoa, back up. Whoa. How many?
Almost 22,000. And that's actually small by MOOC standards.
Oh, okay. All right.
Carry on. Go ahead. So I'm a process oriented person, and I'm a writing teacher. That's what I do, and I'm a writer. And so one thing that very quickly I realized was that the MOOCs were kind of political. Everybody was, you know, legislators were saying, hey, can we get rid of our universities and all of our faculty and, you know, just have these MOOCs, and won't that be cheaper? And, you know, and they came in, it was a perfect storm. MOOCs came along just as, you know, we were having, you know, and the economic crash was kind of happening, and state budgets had lost a lot of tax revenue. And of course, you know, a lot of that money then goes into higher education and supporting that. And they were cutting higher education, and they were looking for ways to cut higher education. So, you know, it was no coincidence that this, you know, that all these things happened sort of together. And, but nobody, well, you know, everybody was writing, you know, hey, MOOCs are the best thing, and they're going to, you know, change everything. And then there were people who were like, MOOCs are evil and horrible, and, you know, we mustn't go down this path. And nowhere in that conversation was anybody who was actually in practice talking about what it meant to teach one of these things and trying to be objective about that. And so I wound up writing a series of articles for the Chronicle of Higher Education, sort of talking about what it was like to go through it. And I really worked very hard to be as objective as I could, and to not, you know, just to tell the story as it was happening, tell the process as it was going on, and to not get embroiled in the is it good, is it bad, but just here's what it looks like from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, you know, I wound up with a lot of information and started thinking, well, okay, so when it was all done, and I had some time to reflect, you know, okay, how did we get here? And what I became really interested in was all that other writing that had happened. And so I became interested in looking at a couple of the foundational books that had been written about MOOCs and disrupting higher education through technology, and not necessarily MOOCs, but any disruption using technology, and to say, okay, how does it work? I mean, who are these people? You know, why do people listen to them? How do their arguments work? And to sort of do a rhetorical mm-hmm. study, which sounds really boring, and it would be really boring if that's all I had done. But I decided to go back to those original process arguments and try to weave the two things together, and to leverage being a creative writer and saying, okay, if I'm going to write this book, I actually want the general public to read this book. I don't just want a handful of colleagues in the academy to read it. I've expended way too much time and energy on this for that. And I think it's actually everyday people who need to be thinking about, because higher education affects every one of us. Whether you go to college or don't go to college, it affects you. And so I've woven into this book a kind of it's like a memoir, and probably some people would associate the style most with the new journalism style. And so to sort of take that personal memoir sort of feel of having been involved in something, and then interleaved in that is the more traditional academic arguments with, you know, footnotes and data and that kind of thing. And basically I just wanted it to be a very readable book. I wanted it to be a book that my parents could read and understand and relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately found the right editor. My acquisitions editor, at the University Press of New England, when he got the original manuscript, he came back and he said, I actually want more of that memoir and less of this academic. He said, you know, that's what's compelling. And so I was delighted to find, to find a publisher who was, you know, really into the project, and they helped me, you know, do a fairly major revision and get the book where it is. And I owe a lot to the whole team at UPNE for doing that. So that's kind of the long and short of what were MOOCs basically, and how did I wind up in this conversation?
Okay. And if I could start right now, if you're listening live, though, and you have a question about this or a comment, or you want to talk to Karen Head, the number is 646-716-9922, and that is a toll-free number in the continental U.S. And again, 646-716-9922 if you have a question. Okay, so this is how you get in. And I like the fact that you took – and as you said, you know, you wove in a first-person account, or sort of a memoir, like a creative nonfiction aspect, or sort of a memoir overlay to make it. I think that also makes it come real to people. You're right; it's not so dry that the average person can just kind of like, oh, never mind, I'll never get this. But you may kind of broke it down for the rest of us with a vision, a picture, sort of a feeling of being there and understanding it. So the first time you started this class, what did you feel would be, I mean, did you have any preconceived notions or questions or concerns about what would be the difficulties or the challenges or what could work?
Well, I think for a writing teacher, the first question becomes, you know, how in the world do I give 22,000 people feedback? And the answer is you can't. and just to put this into context, I mean, so this notion that, you know, this is going to be this great cost-saving thing, there were 19 people on my immediate team who were helping me create this MOOC. There was, another professor at Georgia Tech who was my co-conspirator. She's the person who said, you know, you have to do this. And I was like, why don't you do it? She's like, no, you know, you should do it. so we were together for the whole project. And we had a bunch of postdoctoral fellows who were working with us, who were creating content, who were, you know, helping us sort of shape the course. We had a couple of, you know, technology people who were involved sort of in our immediate team, but then we also had external technology people. We had, you know, a person who had a background in intellectual property law. It was a really sort of collection of people. Now, when I normally plan a class, it's me. And I sit down and I plan my class. And that's not how this worked. I mean, and then, of course, I had to spend several weeks videotaping the lectures, and that was really difficult for me because I don't lecture. That's not my teaching style. So having to lecture was particularly hard, and it was really hard to lecture to a camera. In fact, my colleague who I've just mentioned, Dr. Rebecca Burnett, was at every one of the tapings, and she would actually sit just behind the camera, and I would talk to her because I really found I couldn't talk to the camera. It's just, it was a very, very different mode of teaching, an approach to teaching that I just don't do. And so, and then, you know, I think the real struggle for me was you don't know your students. I mean, they're just out there, and they don't even have to, you know, they don't even have to really identify themselves. They could pick fake names. They can have avatars. They can tell you anything they want to tell you about themselves because it's the internet, and we all know you can be whoever you want to be on the internet. And it was hard for me to not have a relationship with my students because I'm used to having a relationship with my students and knowing who they are and knowing what they care about and, you know, seeing them. And that part was, there was a disconnectedness that was really difficult for me. You know, the students have to, you know, they interact more together. And that was sort of the communities of students that came out of this was probably the best thing that happened, and trying to figure out ways to get my students in my regular classes now to create those smaller out-of-class communities where they're exchanging information and helping each other out. That was one of the really positive things. You know, we had a group of students who, we had students on every continent except Antarctica. And we actually tried to get somebody in Antarctica to sign up, but just so we could say it, but it didn't work out. But we had a group of Russian students, and a couple of them, just to make things easier, because the course was entirely in English, they translated all of our materials into Russian. And we just fortunately happened to have one of our postdoctoral fellows spoke fluent Russian, is from Russia. And she double-checked because we were a little bit worried. We were like, okay, are we becoming a front for some sort of, like, you know, Russian oligarch drug lord? we really didn't know what could possibly be going on. But, you know, they did this free of their own volition. You know, nobody asked them to do this. And, you know, that was no small feat to be translating all of our materials, you know, into Russian for just fellow students. So it's a weird sort of environment that's kind of, it's got its pluses, it's got its minuses. I mean, there's you know, but at the end of the day, you know, the hardest part was that I wasn't interacting with my students, and except in this kind of, you know, sure, there were discussion boards, but there was just no way for me to touch every single student. And that was the thing that bothered me the most. Yeah.
Yeah, because I've only had one online course, which is nothing like exactly like a MOOC. I understand because there's not that many people. And it was in film unit publicity through UCLA. And the instructor, Henri Bellinger, he's one of the foremost people in film unit publicity or PR, so entertainment public relations. And I remember just feeling at first kind of lost, sort of like I thought this would be easy. And then I thought, well, where's the community? You know, where's the chance to get close, you know, ask something personal, make an appointment, get a – and two, I think also people complain or say when you send an email or a tweet or something, one thing that can be a bit of a concern is that you can't always put an inflection, whether a vocal inflection or just a little – wink or just a manner of delivering a line to where people know that it's serious. Is it sarcastic? Is it serious? Is it just kind of kidding around? You know, you just see the words out there. And then at one point I saw where people were putting in comments about other people's work, and then somebody told someone when I was doing, they said, well, doesn't that bother you if other people read your work? I said, no, because we're all sharing what's information. I'm fine with that. You know, we were all there for the same goal. But I would think, yeah, there's that miss, that disconnect of being able to have one-on-one, although I'm interested in knowing how that felt, as well as when you said there were little, there seemed to be certain communities, if I understood you. Well, so
yeah,
how did that work?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. So a lot of the studies that have been done about people who take MOOCs, a really large number of people who took MOOCs already had college degrees. So they were going back to either get more information about something, or, you know, saw it as a kind of continuing ed. And so we sort of had some of those people. We had an entire group of college teachers who were in there, and they were basically, you know, I think they were there for multiple reasons. They were being nosy. They wanted to see what we were doing and, mm-hmm. and judge whether or not, you know, they agreed or disagreed with, you know, some of our approaches. Some of them, you know, were there because they, you know, if there was a train wreck, they wanted to see it. But, you know, they, you know, we, you know, they were also looking to see, okay, is there anything here that I can leverage for my own students? And I think in that sense, that's another one of the positive things about MOOCs, is that, you know, there's information and you can make it available to people. And so we were actually part of a group of four universities when we did ours who were all teaching freshman writing. And we spent a lot of time talking to each other about our courses. And, you know, I absolutely, if I were, you know, teaching a regular freshman English class now, you know, there are times when you just can't get through to a particular student, no matter how many ways you try to explain something to them. There's just mm-hmm. every once in a while there will just be something and that you just can't get it for them. I would absolutely go and pull my colleagues from Ohio State, you know, and say, all right, look, why don't we watch this? and let's see if maybe you understand it from this person. And so, you know, as a resource, I think it's great. But as a substitute for what happens in a traditional college classroom, not so much. And here's a really good chance for me to also say, and it's not the same as traditional distance education. And one thing that I came out of this experience with is I got to know people who are e-learning, distance learning, online learning professionals, people who have been doing this for decades. And they got caught up in this MOOC craze in the sense that MOOC became a kind of metonymy, you know, the word that we used that meant all things online education. And that wasn't fair because there was a long history of people who've been doing this and doing it really well, not to 100,000 students at a time, but, you know, there's really excellent, amazing people who do this, and they've, you know, they've got theory behind what they do, and they've done research about what works and what doesn't work. And I have such a renewed respect for the folks who do that kind of work. And it's important work, because the reality is that not everybody has access to college in the same ways. And so it is true that there are people in other countries who might benefit from online education. It is true that there are veterans who've come back from some of the recent, you know, wars that we've been involved with, who have traumatic injuries, who cannot be in a traditional classroom for all kinds of reasons. There's, you know, the rural farmer. There's, you know, the stay-at-home mom who has, you know, kids, or there's the caretaker who's taking care of, you know, an adult parent, or, you know, someone who's ill. There are lots of populations who can benefit from top quality online education. And by extension, there's nothing wrong with MOOCs as a kind of informal information. Like if you want to, you know, learn how to do something and it's not about a college credit, it's just about getting more information and maybe brushing up on your skills or elevating your skills. I think that, you know, you can kind of go in and maybe just target the one little thing that you want to get some more information about. But it's not the same thing as what happens in traditional distance ed, and it's not the same thing as what happens in traditional classrooms. Because certifying people who you don't know and you can't see is a really tricky business. But online education is not in and of itself a bad thing. It's just that online education kind of got lumped into this craze, which is now pretty much, I mean, nobody's saying that MOOCs are going to change the way that higher education operates. I think MOOCs did change the way that a lot of us thought about how we use technology, and we're now integrating technology more into our classrooms. I feel so much more comfortable now. You know, I live in Atlanta. if it snows here, we have a problem. And it doesn't have to snow much. We're going to close school. And I can actually, I feel really comfortable now recording, you know, whatever I maybe was going to say to students, and then having them watch that briefly, and then having everybody come together in a shared space, like a Google Hangout space, and actually having class. And we've upped our technologies internally so that, you know, we don't even have to use third-party providers. And so there's, I think there's a lot to be said for what you can use technology for. And so, you know, it's you have to look at the whole picture. You can't just look at part of it.
That's true. That's a great point. And especially like the points you make about people, for people who can't attend for whatever, a caregiver, a returning vet for whatever reason, stay-at-home mom, and any of these people, oh my gosh, I'm sure this would be fantastic. You know, it's a blessing. Like they can, if they can't leave, whatever, that's wonderful. So I guess I wanted to, how do people get this? If it's for some added education, for some added information, somebody wants to kind of, I guess, some new info, but for college credit, I mean, how does this, those one of those 22,000 students of creative writing or fiction writing or English at the end? But they can't have one-on-one instruction.
You know, I think it's, again, you know, it's a question of size. The problem with MOOCs is the massive part. I don't think online education is a problem, and in fact, I think it's super important. It works for a lot of people, and a lot of people want to study online. I mean, it's mm-hmm. you know, you didn't much care for your class. I can't imagine doing like any of my 4 degrees online, and I'm the target audience. Mm-hmm. This is something that I talk about in the book. You know, I was a 27-year-old freshman. I'm exactly the person that, you know, when people like to say who this is for, they talk about non-traditional students, how it's ideal for non-traditional students. Well, it's ideal for some non-traditional students. But if you don't really understand that population, and most of the people who write about disrupting higher education are at really big research top schools, places like Harvard, places like mm-hmm. Stanford, places like Georgia Tech, and they don't exactly have their finger on the pulse of what the population of students is like at a community college, or, you know, even a small liberal arts college, or some of the, you know, the smaller state universities. It's not the same population. And to think that you understand what all of those students want is kind of arrogant and short-sighted, because if you haven't ever been involved in that population of people, you probably don't have a very clear idea, and you certainly don't have a clear idea of what it means to teach those people. And so one of the things I call attention to in the book quite a lot is, you know, we're talking about, you know, a handful of people who kind of, you know, told us how all of this was really great, and, you know, but they don't really understand what it's like to be one of the 1.3 million college instructors we have in this country, most of whom are not teaching, you know, one course a semester at Harvard with mm-hmm. tons of assistance whenever they need it. I mean, it's a very different world out there. And so, you know, you may say, well, okay, but technology will make it easier for them. And, you know, there's, you know, we wouldn't, you know, we can serve so many more students and we can do all these things. And it's like, yeah, but serve them how? And one of the things that bothers me most about a lot of these conversations is that they very quickly, whether it's MOOCs or whether it's broad online education and getting rid of the, you know, the smaller schools and saying, well, you know, but, you know, a lot of these students could be served by just having online education, as if, but without a recognition that a lot of those students don't want to have an online education. They want to have a person, you know, they want to have a personal be there in the institution kind of experience. Mm-hmm. And the argument very quickly starts to become, there's going to be two kinds of education at some point. One kind of education is going to be what the elite schools have and will continue to offer, which is the best education that money can buy. And people who can afford that, or who can, you know, get in if they're still being funded, they will enjoy a kind of personal experience with probably a fairly liberal arts background. You know, they're going to get to experiment with different kinds of classes. They're going to, you know, have lots of opportunities. And then there's going to be everybody else. And if everybody else is somehow shuffled to the online world or some new version that's, you know, mostly online, we're saying to those people, well, this is good enough, and you should be happy that you have this. And, you know, at least it's not expensive. I'm particularly, you know, I'm particularly concerned about that, because I was that student who didn't have the money, and I had made life choices that made me a college freshman at 27. And I did go to community college, and I worked all day and went at night. And then, you know, I transferred to a small liberal arts college, and, you know, then I went to graduate school, and things got kind of normalized in graduate school. But I know that I wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation with you, because I would not, at least not about this, because I would not be a college professor if it had not been for the experience I had, which was a traditional one. And yes, it meant lots of hours driving back and forth to campuses and working in the daytime and going at night for a big part of that. There were lots of things, but this presumption that people either don't want that or shouldn't, you know, should be happy to get what they want really bothers me, because I'm a first generation college student, and I think a lot of people who would really benefit would lose out if we start saying, well, you know, and it's really more about, you know, training you for whatever job you're going to have, and we're going to be, you know, much more sort of controlling of what you can and can't take, and, you know, and you need to do this online, and it's all about cost savings. And then, you know, as I said, the handful of people who can get out there and, you know, we jokingly used to say, you know, find themselves, but you do find yourself in college. That's a big part of what college is about. It's that you know, that crazy elective that completely changes your view about whatever it is that you're going to do. And it's not necessarily means that you're going to change your major. It just makes you a more informed engineer, or makes you a more humane scientist, or, you know, whatever the combination is. And if you're like me and you were an English major, you know, that math class made me think differently. You know, those science classes, you know, they changed the way that I saw myself and others. And so, you know, that having that kind of exposure, that sort of general core of learning is just so important. And so my book, in many ways, I mean, if it is, and I think it is more, I have more of an opinion in this book than I did in those original pieces that I wrote, where I was really trying to be objective. I mean, it was time for me with this book to stop being as objective, at least in what concerns me about all of this. I tried to still be objective about talking about the MOOC, and when you do rhetorical analysis of other people's work, I mean, you take their work and you say, well, this is what they say, and this is how that plays, but, you know, that part you have to be objective about. But the memoir part, I really did try to, like, take my experience as a non-traditional student and say, you know what, I'm proof that what you're saying isn't true. And there are many other people like me. And sure, there are people like the ones you talk about who would be happy with that. But we need to have people, you know, people need to have choices. And I don't want to disrupt higher education so that we only have people who are learning a trade and the handful of people who can go to Harvard.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I also want to say, too, start right now, if you want to call in and talk to Karen Head, the number is 646-716-9922. That's 646-716-9922. And actually, Karen, I've had a few people message me. One person, Duffy Odom in Adele, Georgia, Andre Robinson in California, saying that they're just enjoying listening to you and learning. So, and thank you both for letting us know. One thing, though, too, is when people talk about, you know, well, what about the ones where there, maybe there are some where there are a few formal credits or qualifications available through some of the new MOOCs. And I see that in one interview, one article I read, this Professor Andrew Ng, and he said, and of Stanford, he said that it's really, you know, it may not, if you put it on your job, even though you don't have a credit or something, or you know, something like that for the course that you took, said, but many employers favor candidates with completed MOOCs on their CVs, and in quote says it won't necessarily get you the job, but it might get you the interview, maybe showing an employer that you went on your own to further your education or to add to your knowledge about a subject. Did anyone ever mention that to you or feel that they had gotten
sure,
that type of benefit?
And, right, and this is still, you know, credentialing, micro-credentials they're sometimes called. You know, there are a lot of people who, and it's in a company's interest in some ways, if you can just have the skills that they need for you to have, then, and you maybe didn't go to college, you're less expensive to hire. And you're also more expendable. Because what happens when that skill set runs out, when the next technology, and you're not ready for that? So this is the, you know, we need welders, not philosophers argument. And one of my chapters is titled that, and it's a pretty famous argument. In fact, you know, in the last presidential election and the debates, Marco Rubio famously, you know, said this, you know, we need welders, not philosophers. And, you know, it's very important. And, you know, what was hilarious about that is he need only look down the stage to Carly Fiorina, who's perhaps one of the most successful women in the business world. And she has a degree in philosophy. In fact, there are quite a lot of people in who are CEOs who have degrees in philosophy. So, you know, it's again, I think, you know, are we training people for the rest of their life, or are we training people for their first job? If you're training people for their first job, then credentialing is great. And sure, you know, Andrew Ng is actually one of the creators, along with Daphne Kollner, of the Coursera platform, which is the platform I taught my course on. He once sent me a very nice email. He's right in the sense of if you're using this as an add-on, sure, I think it could distinguish you. Let's say you have a degree in computer science and you learned one particular programming language, but then you went back and, you know, you took a MOOC and you really got familiar with some other programming language or some other, you know, hard structure work, or you know other things that were sort of slightly outside of your degree program. Maybe that wasn't your area of specialty, but you already had a computer science degree. You know, I think that's like that's like any kind of additional training that someone might, you know, take on. Sure, I think that's great, and I think MOOCs are fantastic for that sort of thing. And again, a huge majority of people who were taking MOOCs already had college degrees. The question I always come back to for people is, would you want your doctor to have only taken MOOCs?
Yeah.
You know, go ahead.
No, we have someone trying to come into the genie bottle here with us, and welcome to Madame Perry's Salon, and come in and talk with me and Karen Head.
Hi, Jennifer. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Hey.
Is our?
I think I know that voice.
This voice is someone. He has his own cushion. He has his own big cushion right here, a comfy one in Madame Perry's Salon. Welcome, Colin Kelly.
Thank you, Jennifer. I've been trying to listen here and there as I've been like trying to get home from the supermarket and all that. So I've been listening in my car as I've been sitting in traffic. So I rushed in the door to try to call before it was over. So
So what do you think? Would you take a MOOC?
What's that? I've never done a MOOC before. Not yet. Maybe.
Go ahead, Karen. You were going to. Yeah.
What I was going to ask him was, you know, isn't he tired of sort of hearing about this? But, you know, to give props where props are due, I mean, Colin, who is, you know, not the kind of person who, you know, I would normally inflict my academic texts on, you know, read some early chapters of this book, and he was really part of my test audience, you know, and I was like, you know, is this compelling? Like, would you want to keep reading this? And, you know, he was tough on me in a few places, you know, early on. He was, nope, not yet. but he knows good writing and compelling stories. And so, yeah, it was tough love, but I know I can count on him for that.
Right. Well, we do this all the time. I mean, I've known Karen for years now. And so we trade work back and forth, whether it's this kind of work or it's poetry. When I was working on, especially when I was working on the last novel, Leaving Paris, she read some early versions of that, especially the character that I wrote in the book that was inspired by her. So I had to make sure I was nailing down, you know, the essence of Karen Head in what I was writing, but also just I really admire. I just think we're really simpatico when it comes to, especially in poetry, you know, in our writing style and our philosophy and what we like. And so Karen is always really, you know, she's always got a good critical eye, and she always kind of steers me in the right direction with the poems. So I always appreciate that.
I'm glad. So, you've read Disrupt This, MOOCs and the Promise of Technology, haven't you?
I've read a little bit. I haven't read the whole thing yet. I've read a little bit of it. It's sitting here on my coffee table to finish reading it, but I haven't read the whole completed thing yet. No. So, it really isn't. I mean, you know, I'm fascinated by MOOCs mainly because Karen has been involved with it now for, you know, a number of years, and I've heard a lot of the war stories, so to speak, about, you know, what's been happening with it. But I've never participated in a MOOC, and so, I mean, I'm looking forward to actually reading the rest of the book in its final form and, you know, learning more about it, because I feel like I know a lot of it because I was kind of with her on the journey, you know, as she was, you know, recording all of those sessions, and, you know, it was gearing up and getting the grant and all that. So, yeah, so, I mean, I've kind of been there, so I kind of know. So I'm looking forward to reading the final book.
War stories, you say, Colin. Are there war stories in here
Well, there are.
What?
Well, you know, I mean, one of the scariest things that happened was I had a stalker. And you know, when you put yourself out there, you know, I mean, there's the public me, right? I mean, there's Karen the professor, mm-hmm. you know, most days at Georgia Tech, and then there was suddenly Karen, you know, who's, you know, I've got 22,000 people looking at me.
Right.
And they think they know you. And mm-hmm. you know, we had somebody who, you know, fortunately we traced that person to the UK, although it was a little unsettling because I taught the last part of the MOOC. I actually taught remotely in Oxford because mm-hmm. we launched late and I had to leave for England because I was teaching there in the summer. And but, you know, this person kept calling and, you know, was trying to get people to give him my personal cell phone number, and he wouldn't leave information about who he was. And, I mean, was really harassing people on my staff, you know, really sort of, you know.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was spooky, right? I mean, so, you know, there are all kinds of. And so war stories, as Colin sort of tells it, I mean, there are a lot of unintended, unexpected things that came mm-hmm. out of doing this. And, you know, I couldn't have predicted it but by the same token, nobody else is predicting it either. And in trying to write about these things, I mean, that's one of the things that I say, you know, and people say, well, you know, you could have a stalker, one of your students at Tech could stalk you. And I'm like, yes, but my students at Tech have actually been vetted. We know who every single one of them is. You know, there's a lot more information, and there is a screening process. You don't just show up in my class at Tech. I mean, you know, you actually apply and you get in, and there's a lot more that's involved. And so, you know, they for a while, for a couple of years, Tech did everything it could to wipe me, my contact information, so people couldn't, you know, get to me as a result of the MOOC. They took down all my office information, took down my phone number, created a second email for me so that I could give my regular email to people and then give this other email sort of to the general public so I could filter things. Yeah, I mean, there's you know, experiences like that, and then, you know, and then other, you know, things that sort of happened. So one of the most lively discussions that happened on the discussion boards was a conversation about how I was dressing in the lectures, the lecture videos. And it was fascinating to sort of watch. And what was really interesting to me is I was one of the only women doing it at that point. And there still are not anywhere near as many women who did it, have done it, as men. And I had male professors and colleagues who were doing this simultaneously. And I was asking them, I was like, has anybody ever said anything about how you dress? And they were like, no. And in fact, you know, I had one colleague who kind of wore this exact same thing every single shoot, like through the entire 8 weeks of his class. He never changed his outfit. and I felt that was a little, for me, that was just too strange. I just didn't want to stay in the same outfit. But yeah, I mean, this kind of, you know, things like that. And then, you know, one of the funnier stories, well, was my hair. You know, I am a woman of a certain age, and I actually started graying at 14, so I was pretty much fully gray before I turned 40. And I had to spend a lot of extra money during this period when we were shooting these videos because I couldn't, my roots couldn't come in because I'm almost completely gray. And the videographer very delicately said to me, you know, we're getting flash off of, you know, the roots of your hair. We really can't shoot it until you get it colored again, which was just, you know, these are not things that normally come up in my classes, you know.
And also don't come up for men as well, because so there's a giant double standard.
Yes. And that's very much, so this, Karen, that's very much of a showbiz aspect, isn't it?
Right. Well, and I think, because you know, eventually, if MOOCs had sort of continued to be a thing, I mean, I predicted, you know, at what point are the real professors going to stop being the professors on the video, and are we going to start hiring actors, right, to sort of deliver the content material because, well, why not? I mean, you know, you need people who are interesting and engaging and don't have, you know, a face or a wardrobe or a voice for radio. You know,
it's too bad because James Franco would have been perfect. You know, he could have been the MOOC king.
Well, and yeah, I mean, I'm sure some graduate student out there is doing research or has already done research on, you know, gender and you know, standards of beauty and whether or not that translates into how many people sign up for your MOOC and, yeah, it was, I mean, you know, these were just conversations I never, ever expected to have as a college professor. You know, I just never thought that, you know, and wearing tons of makeup and, you know, it's just, it was completely foreign because it is show business in its own way.
Wow, because I think, you know, I've heard people that I know that are on the air, on camera for news show, like weather people or news anchors, and they say that they'll get called into an office going, okay, what's going on with your eyebrows? You know, or what is this about your hairstyle or color? And I'm thinking, but that should be for, you know, for that job. But for an instructor, for a teacher of a course in the MOOC, that would have to be, to me, just a little bit disconcerting. And like Colin said, there's definitely a double standard there. And, you know, and it kind of makes me think about one of your Oxford colleagues, I believe, Sally Mapstone. One of the first comments she said, I saw in a video on the BBC about MOOCs was that. She said, well, we shouldn't all, she said, we shouldn't all go rushing lemming-like onto the bandwagon. You know, but I would say, Sally, it's not just the bandwagon. You'd have to get to the, you know, professional hair and makeup room and everything else. So a colorist, it'd be much more
yeah,
fun
I
than
spent,
that.
My hairdresser, you know, made a small fortune off of me during those few months.
Well, listen, it has been so much fun to have you here, and I hate to say that I'm out of time, but can you tell people where to find out more about you? I know your Twitter is at PoetPhD, and where can people find, and Colin, I'm so glad to have you here because you are a part of the story.
It was my pleasure.
Can you tell people
pleasure.
Where? It's always a delight, Colin. And, yeah, where can people get the book, and where can they find out more about you?
The book is available at all major book retailers. You know, it's on all the online. You can get it directly from the press, University Press of New England, which is upne.com. You can find out more. I have a public Facebook site. Karen J. Head actually is what comes up there, and I share information about the book there. There's some other interviews that have been done about the book. If you Google the name of the book, you know, most of those things will come up. But, you know, mostly what I hope is that people, anybody who cares at all about higher education, you know, and really that should be most of us, you know, get a copy of the book, read it, you know, tell your friends about it. I really meant this book to be for the general public and so that people would understand more about higher education. I just think there's a lot there to learn way beyond MOOCs. I mean, we focused on the MOOC aspect. MOOCs were the reason to talk about higher education, but there's a lot going on in higher education that everybody needs to pay attention to.
Yeah, and I thank you for making it, understanding it and interesting, because it's a fascinating subject, but making it interesting to all of us outside of academia as well to understand. And I wish you much success with this book, Karen Head, and you are always welcome back to Madam Perry's Salon, where